Hey everyone, it's Rich. I had planned to talk about the concept of compartmentalizing one's digital life and how that can make you more private. But in the world of podcasting, sometimes an opportunity comes along that you just can't pass up. Don't worry, we'll get back on track in our next episode. When I was a teenager, my dad used to tell me lots of stories. He was an opinionated man, and his narratives, well, they were often quite animated. From his time in the military, to married life, and to his business travels, his tales were long and very thorough. Despite the variety, they always had a common theme: that life is better lived with a purpose. Our guest today embodies this mindset. JB Benjamin is a visionary technologist who builds products that safeguard people's privacy. From his home base just outside of London, he runs several companies on a mission to combat constant surveillance. JB is quite a maverick. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. This was somewhat of a wild episode, but he's passionate about what he does, and I think it makes for a fascinating listen. I didn't talk much this time around, but it worked out for the best. We covered a multitude of topics, from cryptocurrency and crypto wallets, to encryption technologies, to cryptography, the blockchain, and of course, privacy in general. JB weaved in a few stories along the way, and as with my dad, they always shared a common theme. Enjoy the episode. You're listening to Privacy Files. This episode is brought to you by Anonymy Labs, makers of MySudo, the world's only all-in-one privacy app, and Sudo Platform, the cloud-based platform companies turn to for seamlessly integrating privacy solutions into their software. And please check out our newest offering, MySudo VPN, now available in the App Store and Play Store, a consumer VPN that is actually private. JB, welcome to the show.
Hi, how's it going? Great to be here.
Best way to start is just kind of give us a little history. How did you get to this point where you are such an advocate for privacy?
Kind of all started in my childhood recently. I was a child of the 1980s, so I was born in a period of massive civil unrest in the United Kingdom. I was born in Birmingham. I grew up in a council estate in a really rough part of Birmingham. I was homeschooled and I was reading Descartes, Baudrillard, and Shakespeare by the time I was 5 and 6, writing essays. I was on protest marches for the freeing the Birmingham Six, you know, me and my little orange jacket holding a placard, 3 times the height of me. Me and my sister were doing that. We used to frequent a place called Zebedee's Cafe in Birmingham, in a place called Alum Rock, which has a blue plaque to it now, because it was the hotbed seat of socialism and communism in the 1980s in Birmingham. I was always passionate about really the human element of things. How do we make sure that we have parity? And I don't say equality, because the concept of equality is actually really kind of dumb, because the reality is we are maybe created equal, but we are physically and psychologically different. We have different attributes, different traits, different qualities. So if you were to say that we want true equality, this basically means that in every single thing, we would set a threshold benchmark and tell everybody to hit the same benchmark. Problem is if you set your benchmarks set on the fittest, it basically means you're creating this instant level of inequality that nobody can ever really attain, because it becomes whoever dictated the levels in the first place that sets the grading system. So I say parity, where even though we are physically and intellectually different, we still have access to exactly the same level of resourcing, which basically means you remove the concept of privilege. Now, even though I was born on a council estate, I grew up in the Depression of the 80s. I still consider myself privileged because I ended up with a really good education. I ended up reading a lot more than most other people did, most of my peers would have done. So it gave me a very different outlook on life. When you grow up like that and you see all of the crazy injustices around you, you start looking at how are these injustices furthered? How do they continue? How are they propagated? Given that almost all of humanity by default is actually good-natured and kind of kind to each other, what is it that changes this point of view? What is it that brings in the exploitation of each other? Unfortunately, our business practices really heavily support it. When you have businesses that seem to be only able to make money by virtue of ads, it creates a problem. Now, how are ads a problem? Well, ads are a problem because they rely on personalized data. Okay, no big whoop. But it becomes a big whoop when you realize how your personal data is gathered. Now, every time you log into Facebook, wherever you are, be it sat on the can, just doom scrolling it, it is pinging all kinds of information about you. Facebook's servers are looking at the information on your phone. Where is your phone located in space? Where is it located in time and space? Is it near other phones that have the software? What are you doing at the time? Have you looked at anything previously? What were your likes and dislikes? How quickly did you zoom away from a page? Did you tap on a link? Did you click on a link? All of these things allow a platform provider to build up this incredibly personal picture about you, your likes, your desires, your loves, your dirty little kinks. All those things that you think are just are private things to yourself, they can intuit, guess, and infer, and then target at you. I mean, how many times have we been in a group chat with friends, family, or spam on WhatsApp, and we've, say, spoken about some trainers, and then we've gone onto Facebook and instantly seen ads for those trainers all over Facebook and Twitter and Google. Yes, this thing called cookie retargeting, and it happens insidiously on every single device that you're logged in. Now, this isn't in itself a problem until it becomes exploitative, i.e. it starts working to the detriment of yourself. And we saw this with Facebook and the Cambridge Analytica scandal, when massive amounts of personal information was sold to various shady little think tanks to focus political advertising on the people most susceptible to this form of, let's be honest and call it what it is, manipulation, to vote for the people that they want voted in. Now, as we saw, you know, in the United Kingdom, we had a massively manipulated Brexit referendum, and we had a massively manipulated vote. The 2019 elections, which were heavily funded by Russian and Israeli money. These were elections in the United Kingdom that were by no shape or means independent, but it all became propagated and enhanced and pushed even further because of what by the huge chunks of data handed over by Facebook with no permission whatsoever to a private company. And this is where the sticking point is: permission, informed consent. If everybody realized the true value of their digital selves, I can tell you now that nobody would be using these platforms saying, yeah, we're cool. Bear in mind, what's the deal here? The deal is that we get to use these platforms for free. Cool. But what are these platforms bringing us? They're meant to make our lives easier. I don't know about the majority of people, but you know, it seems like the reality is they get to make millions of dollars per second, by the way, millions of dollars per second from your digital data and your breadcrumbs, while you end up with mental health issues and your children end up with mental health issues. Bear in mind, look at the recent reports released in which Facebook were told that the way in which they were marketing Instagram to the youngest females in our communities was actually harming their psychological and emotional well-being. And Facebook's response is, let's bury that report and carry on anyway, because that's big, big money. So I decided that in everything I do when it comes to business, A, I'm going to take these companies on, because if they're going to exploit us for profit, maybe I can just about live with that if they're going to use something, use the profits for some good. But here we are in the 21st century. We still don't have any universal basic income. We have mass automation happening, and we have all the biggest corporations run by the same groups of people who are only interested in one thing: ostensible godhood. Oh, sorry. And launching shaped rockets into space at an crazy rate and for no ostensibly good reason other than we must inhabit another world while we haven't even solved the problems we've got on this one. So yeah, that was a very long answer to your question, I realized. It was like a 7 minutes answer to a very, what should have been a very quick question.
How about maybe to set the stage, you're involved in a lot of different technologies. You got many companies that you're working on. Which one do you want to tackle first?
Okay, my first company was Cryotech. I set that baby up in 2017, and I created the world's first post-quantum encrypted video chat messenger, Vox Messenger. Now, what does the buzzword post-quantum mean? It's a buzzword. It's a fancy marketing thing. It just basically means that we're using encryption algorithms which are in orders of magnitude stronger than the current standard. And the current standard is the RSA EC, or elliptic curve encryption standard. Now, for those of us who know our encryption history, we know of the rumors, theories, and stories of the potential, hugely potential, prior compromise of the EC standard at RSA years ago at prior NIST competitions. And that's why we don't use them. We don't use elliptic curve. We use what is called lattice-based cryptography, which is based on finding a curve or a line through a lattice grid, whereas elliptic curve is just finding a line or a curve through a curve. And one is infinitely stronger than the other. The reason they call it post-quantum is because the current standards, which are used by WhatsApp, Signal, and pretty much everybody else in existence, we can all say with a fair level of confidence be destroyed by even a current generation quantum supercomputer. And there are even research papers out there indicating that may have already been done, in fact. We're still waiting for a lot of these papers to be independently peer-reviewed and stuff, but it's looking extremely likely that it's incredibly easy to break these. So we're using Round 5 and Falcon, which, if people do their research, were all NIST runners-up in the NIST competition. The reason we didn't actually go with the NIST winners is because the NIST winners include algorithms made by a company called PQ Data. Now, I was lucky enough for the PQ Data funding pitch deck to slip into my hands, and I know who their funders are, and their funders include the NSA, Bank of England, and the Rothschilds Group. So we know that they are not interested in consumer privacy in any shape or form. So that's why I'm using the rebellious alternatives, which have already been peer-reviewed publicly and privately, and have already been intensely researched as well.
Wow. Before we continue on this, how did you become so passionate? I can feel it.
It's just who I am. I get passionate about stuff. I'm a firm believer in if you are going to do something, do it with your all. Go full beans. As a kid, I used to have all the same mental well-being problems that all modern teenagers have, except I did not have them exacerbated by modern social media, you know. But I used to be incredibly worried about talking to other people and being out there and people disliking me. And as soon as I got to my 30s and I became a little more confident in myself, I did mushrooms. I was kind of like, you know what? Who cares? When you do mushrooms and you see the biorhythmic energy glowing around flora and fauna around you, you suddenly realize that your place in the universe is incredibly small. And you suddenly realize that the opinions of other people in their places in the universe are absolutely meaningless unless they're projected at you with such negative energy that you have to address them. So my methodology for life is I will maintain incredibly positive energy. When things are going wrong for me, I don't go, oh God, I'm so unlucky, because that is creating that reality. I instead go, pardon my French, it's going to work out. I have faith in the universe, and the universe never lets me down, actually. I mean, it's not as easy as that. It's not some wishy-washy, eat, pray, love approach to life. It's about the knowledge that if you just work hard at everything and you give everything your absolute all and you can say you've done 100%, there is a very high probability of success. And even if you're unsuccessful, you can take a learning from that unsuccessful component and be successful next time. So when you think about things like that, you remain very positive, you end up with lots of energy, and you don't end up experiencing the downs of failure, because a failure becomes a positive experience for you.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. They know everything about you. They've got your data saved.
You better watch out. You'll probably cry. Your account's been hacked, and we're telling you why. Bad actors are coming to town.
They're making a list. They found it online. They purchased their gifts with your cards this time. Bad actors are coming to town.
Just like Santa, bad actors are often hidden from sight. But fear not. With MySudo, you have the ideal safeguard. MySudo lets you control what information you share, ensuring your digital life stays private. This holiday season, stay joyful, bright, and most importantly, secure. To learn more, go to MySudo.com. That's MySudo.com. Stay private.
On the cryptocurrency front, this is one that always fascinates me. I don't participate in it, but I hear lots of different viewpoints about how safe it is versus, oh, it's so easily hacked. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about technology you're working on that side of it, and maybe give us kind of the layman's view of how safe is crypto in general.
Oh, let's not get twisted. Okay, crypto itself, or more specifically, blockchain, which is the technology that crypto sits on, is incredibly safe and is incredibly mathematically and also magnitude hard, if not plausibly impossible, to hack, even by a quantum supercomputer. I mean, bear in mind, if you were to try and use a brute force random number generator or something to try and break a seed phrase for Bitcoin, it would take you in orders of magnitude over a trillion years to do so, even with a quantum supercomputer. This is the levels of complexity we're talking about. Now, the crypto industry is the wild, wild west. It literally is. It's like the early internet days where literally everything was a neon flashing scam sign. The crypto space is that. It's full of the crypto chads and the scammers and the flakes and the people who are only interested in making a quick buck with actually providing anything. But as should always be remembered, it was like that in Web 2. Bear in mind, the reason why people end up falling afoul of the criminality of Web 3 largely is because people do not understand the implicit difference between Web 2, i.e. the 20th century, and Web 3. Let us call it the 21st or the 22nd century. Now, in Web 2, you were not king. You were not the center of your universe. Your data was the center of your universe, but you lived in a universe where other people took care of you. Your security was took care of you. Your platform was taken care of for you. Your services were taken care of for you. And you gave away your data in exchange for these access for all of these things and these people taking care of you while providing you a service. Now, we already know that's not what happened. The reality is they built these platforms. They kept you in there, sucked as much money out of you as possible, and then threw you to the wolves and then provided no form of safety or railguards. I mean, anybody who's been abused on Twitter and Facebook knows what it's like to try and actually get a complaint through or get a post removed. It ain't happening. So, but in Web 3, you are the king or the queen. You are the center of your universe. Now, this means, yes, you have digital sovereignty. You own everything. Yes, my existence can be monetized. But it also means you're responsible for your own safety and security. And this is the thing that everybody seems to forget, which means, guess what? Yes, you are responsible for the safety of your wallet. You are responsible for the fact that, as opposed to writing down the seed phrase for your wallet on pen and paper and sticking that pen and paper, that piece of paper in a safe, you instead decided to screenshot it on your phone, that you download tons of porn and tons of indiscriminate, oh, get rich quick, money-making ads, apps onto, and all your ads revenue onto. You have them all operating on that phone, then you screenshot it. And where does that screenshot go to? That screenshot goes to iCloud. And it goes to Google, which basically means if those have been compromised or hacked, guess what? They got your seed phrase. Now, in the old world, you could file a complaint and they'd be responsible for the loss of your money and they'd have to replace it. Yay, decentralization. I just wish they wouldn't control what I say. Comes at a payoff, doesn't it? A little trade-off. But when you're the center of your universe, you're responsible for that safety. All of a sudden, your money isn't insured anymore, is it? If you're a dumb and lose it. This is the reason why Web 2 seems so attractive, because you can be an idiot and you're insured and regulated up the yazoo. But, ladies and gentlemen, the same thing is coming to Web 3. Yes, everybody is saying we don't like governments and we don't trust government CDBCs and we don't trust regulation. Well, sorry, most of y'all's got demonstrated to the governments and the rest of the world that you're incompetent scamming that just want to rip each other off. We all thought that in the crypto space, we'd all be a big kind of crypto loving and we'd all self-regulate. Yeah, look at where it got us. It gave us the likes of Machi and Poorly OX and Blur and all of these other platforms which are just there to just suck money out of you. This, unfortunately, though, is the thing that people need to take away and remember. In Web3, you are the center of the universe. If you are the center of that universe and you have digital sovereignty and you have the ability to commercialize and make money from your digital self, you better believe it's going to come with the same level of responsibility as being a government. You are now prime minister of your own world. It's cool. It's amazing. But it basically also means there's consequence. It's like those people who say, freedom of speech. I want freedom of speech. I want to call everybody the N-word that I don't like, but then want to complain when I get punched in the face by the aforementioned N-word. Freedom of speech is beautiful, ladies and gentlemen. It's just not freedom of consequence. And that's what we need to remember, particularly in Web3. Web3, there is consequence. Blockchain is a beautiful piece of technology. It is non-repudiable. It cannot be effectively broken. And if you're using true proof of work as opposed to proof of stake, it cannot be cornered, and it cannot be adverse manipulated on the most easiest of levels.
What does that mean? Can you get into that a little bit more, proof of work?
So proof of work versus proof of stake. Proof of work blockchains are, in my humble opinion, the only true blockchain. Because if we look at what a blockchain's strength is, a blockchain's strength actually lies in the convergence, combination, and transfer of what? Energy. Work is energy. When we see fusion tech could become mainstream, proof of work blockchains become, in fact, the most viable form of blockchain all of a sudden, because you can miss out huge components of the financial chain. You are literally just trading energy, be it the work or the motion of somebody doing something, or fusion energy, the energy needed to actually power a machine, crunch a number. It is just the trading of energy. Now, given that we are actually energetic beings, that basically means a proof of work blockchain is perhaps the most symbiotic form of technology that we could actually look at using in the modern age. So proof of work works on the basis of computers or a mechanism solving mathematical problems, and this verifying a set of string and you being rewarded for these outcomes being deliberated. Proof of work is fully decentralized because it's the combination of all these different nodes working together on the same thing combined, which gives you the whole, which basically means you could chop off one component of it and it will still function the same because that information is stored across the entire network. That is very strong. That is incredibly resilient if it can be scaled. And its key problem is scaling. To scale it requires energy. Now, one of the things we're told is that proof of work is the devil. Proof of work is an ecological disaster. Okay, it's a half and half. It's a half truth and it's a half lie. The truth is that proof of work blockchains are one of the most feasible form of blockchain and data storage and data utility out there, especially in terms of giving people a viable reward for their participation in it. Here comes the lie. It's an ecological disaster. Here comes the half truth. It is only an ecological disaster if mainstream banking wanted to put up the computing power necessary for them to take control of it. And that's the point of the story they miss out. It becomes an ecological disaster if the financial institutions, the mainstream institutions, were to spin up the servers necessary for them to take mechanistic control of a proof of work blockchain. Now, proof of stake is completely different. It works like this. My bag is bigger than yours. I have more votes. Screw you. That's proof of stake. Banks love it. Oh my God, yes, because it fulfills the centralization requirement. This is why if you look at Ethereum cannot be called the people's network. 98% of all the nodes are in the United States, and something like 60 or 70% of those nodes are some way controlled or influenced by a mainstream financial institution like BlackRock somewhere. So they are the proof, the network that is actually going to be the one that really is going to be the best for everyone is proof of work, especially once we have near infinite energy sources like fusion tech. But at the moment, we're stuck with proof of stake. And the way it's sold to people is that if you want mainstreaming, you're going to have to comply. We need compliance. And why do we need compliance? Because y'all can't be trusted. Now, in Vox Crypto, we thought to ourselves, yeah, that's not really cool because I actually don't like governments. I don't particularly like big corporations, which means we don't really like ourselves that much, actually. But what I do like is being able to provide a product that can compete against everybody else and give people at least something of what they want. So what have we got in Vox Crypto? Well, Vox Crypto is kind of special already. In Vox Crypto, we've got a special smart contract. It works easier if I just tell you the flow. Imagine you want to send $50 to 100, 200, or even 500 people. At the moment, if you're going to do that, it's $100 times 100 plus the transaction fee. And that transaction fee is going to go up scalar for every second that you're on the chain, because what does it work on? Scarcity of resources. So every time you're submitting that next transfer, you're making the resources get more scarce. So you're going to see that gas fee go up in line with the number of transfers you're doing. That's presupposing you're doing the transfers at a quiet time of the day and presupposing that Yuga Labs haven't decided to dump Otherworld or some other crazy piece of NFT crap on the chain and just push prices up anyway. People who don't understand crypto or not, I'm saying with that one. And what ours does instead is think of it like this. You could either send $100 to over 100 or 500 people, or you could send different amounts to all of these different people in a single transaction. And it wraps the transaction, so you only pay one transaction fee and all of the rest go out in one hit. Now, at the moment, the way we've optimized it, it works out you're paying 30, 40% of what you would pay if you paid them all individually. And we don't have conventional wrapping where, bear in mind, lots of people, everybody else in this space who does the whole the group transaction wrapping thing, the way they do it is they have a smart contract, all the money goes into that smart contract, and then it splits it afterwards. So you can trick it into having a single transaction. That's very cool and all that, but it's also absolute BS because it creates this beautiful, juicy attack surface. I mean, that smart contract then becomes the single most attacked thing because it's sitting there with all of this money. It's sitting there waiting to be split. Our smart contract stores no funds. It literally is a straight pass-through. So if you even try to crack our smart contract, you don't gain anything from doing so, actually. You don't gain any funds. As far as we know, it's unique in that space. The reason we've done it that way is because we're going through what? FCA financial registration, which basically means it behooves us not to be hanging onto people's funds, actually. Also, because I come from a cybersecurity background and a behavioral psychology background, I also know that as I'm building a product, am I building something that becomes a juicy target that people are going to want? And by building a smart contract that splits the funds after the initial point of transfer, I'm building exactly that. I'm building this lovely little come get me. So we don't work that way. It's a straight pass through. Now, this means, yes, of course, nothing is unhackable. And we ain't going to claim that. The way we operate is we work on the premise that we do our very best to make sure that we don't launch stuff that is broken from day one. If something is broken, we will report on it. We will hold our hands up and publicly announce it. And then we go fix it.
Nice.
It's the only way to be as far as we're concerned. Yes, and we do have shareholders who will tell me continuously, JP, you can't operate this way. It's not how it's done. And I will point out to them, baby, it's the 21st century. It's how it's done now. Everything is about transparency and accountability at all three of my companies. This is the reason why we also publish all of our financial records. We're not into tax evasion. We're not into hiding stuff because I designed my companies around the things that I absolutely hate in the industry right now. Personality CEOs are roaming the world like dinosaurs and causing chaos, even though they actually have the ability between all of them to fix some of the major problems for their consumers. Bear in mind, this is the thing that all of my competitors are forgetting in their race to fulfill business and consumer modeling based on the Freud and Barnes model of consumerism. They're all forgetting that every single one of these people they're exploiting is their consumers. When they're treating their workers badly and when they're refusing to allow their workers to unionize, and they're refusing to acknowledge workers' rights in factories and moving factories to countries that have weak human rights records, they're forgetting that those workers are also, on the flip side, their consumers. By being bad to their workers, they're creating a whole group of people who can badmouth them and actually poison their consumer base directly, not indirectly. Your company and your business flowers and blooms on whether or not your work, predominantly whether or not your workers are happy, actually. This is the reason why we have these kind of like hard lines. I'll give you an example. If we have a member of staff or a CEO who ends up turning out to be like some kind of Andrew Tate kind of guy or personality, yeah, they're gone. And no, it isn't wokeism. It's just that I will not inflict that on my coworkers. I'm not going to pretend that it's okay. No, it's not. It's vile. It really is. And in the companies, and we see this very visibly, in the companies that support this, in the companies that support a internal culture of bants, laddism, machismo, whatever you want to call it, their products exploit their consumers. I know that people say you have to divorce the product or the art from the creator, but you can't because we see it all the time. We see the creators becoming incredibly powerful. And what are they doing with their power? I already know that somebody who's building technology that could be potentially used by millions, just like my kid, if my child goes out there and turns out to be Hannibal, it is my responsibility to go hunt that motherfucker down and take him out because I created that child. And it's the same for my products. If my products do bad and exploit people, that's on me. It's not on other people. So it becomes complicated. It means that you try to do your best the whole time. And that's part of becoming passionate about your stuff. If you're passionate about your things, hopefully you'll be passionate about it in the right way. You'll keep doing the greater good with it, which probably makes my investors scream because they want me to be focused on profits. But what I try to explain is profits come by being good.
JB, you're a modern revolutionary.
Uh-oh, that's going to get me assassinated.
Hey, let's switch gears for just a little bit. The privacy concept in general. We talk to a lot of people who are, we call them the normies. They're just the average folks that, yeah, it sounds like it's interesting to them to be private. They don't know where to start. But, and then there's the extreme folks that I'll put you in that category just for the moment.
No.
I guess where I'm going is, do you think that technology will eventually just solve these problems, or is it going to be a combination of that and the individual taking more ownership of their personal information? Where do you see that going?
It's going to be a combination of both. I mean, I used to be senior lecturer of computer science at Ravensbourne University London. I used to teach cybersecurity at degree level. And I found out that I was one of the only, if not the only, person teaching cybersecurity with an entire module on behavioral psychology. Because most hacks that happen in the outside world don't happen with somebody sat there with the glow of the light on them and Mr. Anderson being told to follow the white rabbit. Most of the time it happens because people are lax and irresponsible. It's called social engineering. It's incredibly easy to social engineer. It's incredibly easy to phone somebody up and pretend to be somebody you're not, and then to engage them in some light chat, which makes them feel comfortable, which then allows them to feel like they can trust you, which then makes them think they can hand over this information to this faceless entity they have never met. And part of that is down to how we're schooled and educated. Bear in mind, in most of the schooling systems, we're taught to implicitly trust authority. And that the world is black and white, and there is good and there is bad, and that's that. Well, I mean, I don't know about you, but what I'm being shown right now in mainstream news is that a lot of the people we thought were the good guys are doing some fairly nutty stuff and saying some nutty things. So I wouldn't necessarily say the world is kind of black and white in that way. Technology is going to help us to make it easier to protect ourselves. But if we do things like believing the first Instagram DM that tells us that there is a cute honey who's ready to video chat us for free, and then we have to download some piece of software to our phone, it doesn't matter how many alerts come up on the phone saying, don't do it. I'm your AI guardian. Don't do it. Seriously. People still do it because a lot of people cannot subsume their baser urges. So it really does come down to us as the individual. I mean, I don't know about you, but I am inundated with spams and scams, and some of them are incredibly convincing. But it doesn't take 30 seconds, ladies and gentlemen, to hover your mouse over the link to see what the link says, or to press and hold the link on if you're using mobile to see what the link says. Now, if the email is saved to come from Microsoft and the login page link says telegram.tme/blah, blah, 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 just maybe, don't click the link. Just because there's a big bosomy whatnot on it, maybe, just maybe, don't click the link. So a lot of it does come down to us. Security and privacy does start with us. And no, you don't have to be a paranoid Area 51, silver hat wearing, EFF jacket wearing member to deal with security. It's just changing how we think a bit about our lives. If you're a religious person, this should be really easy. You don't just have a spiritual soul. You also have a digital soul. Now, I hate to say this to those religious people. Your digital soul is actually really provable. It's called cookies, metrics, these digital breadcrumbs. Now, we don't sell our soul to the devil. Well, I mean, some of us do, like, you know, rock stars, rockers, and those people, because why wouldn't you? If you want to get good at playing guitar, who do you go to? The devil. You don't go to Jesus, for example. You go to the devil. He's the one that can play the violin. Given that we don't give away our souls so very easily, at the very same time, we shouldn't give up our digital selves so very easily. I mean, what these platforms is doing to the majority of us, in some ways, I can kind of smile because my ancestors were victim to the transatlantic slave trade. Now, all of us are victim to the social media digital slave trade. All of us are victim to this. Most individuals realized the monetary amounts that they're actually making off of people just visiting Facebook and just going to just doing a few search algorithms. People would actually really stop doing it. This is the reason why in the EU, they are actually passing laws and changes to GDPR that will actually require social media platforms to provide the monetary value of a European user's data to them as part of their social media experience. That's huge. Sorry, America, you don't get this. We've actually got better privacy laws in Europe. This is going to cause an absolute storm for the platforms because guaranteed, the minute a person sees that, they're going to be like, hold, what, hey, where are my control sliders? Where's my cash out button, Facebook? Where's my money? And that's coming. And all of these platforms are terrified. And that's the reason why you see Facebook saying, Europe, we're going to leave if you don't change this. And Europe's kind of like, well, okay. I'm sure there's somebody who can build another one. And there is. It's called Vox Alive. I've already built it. Just going to put that out there. Vox-alive.xyz. It's already out there. End-to-end encrypted. No ads. Monetize your data.
But I think last time I checked, I think now Meta's coming up with a paid version for Europe just to kind of get around this.
Yeah. And who's going to use a paid version of Facebook? Using a paid version of Facebook is dumb as those people that actually pay for Facebook ads and wonder why they see nothing but bots.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
Hey there, go-getters. Ready to tackle those New Year's resolutions? We know you are, and so is MySudo. MySudo isn't just about privacy. It's about organization and focus, too. With multiple pseudo profiles, you can separate your work life from your home life, your side hustle from your social connections. No more distractions, no more clutter. Just pure resolution-achieving productivity. Looking to get fit? Create a fitness pseudo. Want to learn a new language?
Hola.
There's a pseudo for that. Each with its own dedicated email and browser to keep you laser-focused on your goals. So let's make this the year you stick to your resolutions. Download MySudo and start living a more organized, focused life today. Here's to a productive new year. To learn more, go to MySudo.com. That's MySudo.com. Stay private.
It's always fascinating to hear people's perspectives on where the privacy space is going, because there's that younger crowd, especially 30 and under, they're like, hey, I've only known the internet. It's already too late for me. My information's out there. I don't care, right? I give up. And then there's those that are kind of in the middle that something happened to them. There was an event. They had their credit card information hacked. Somebody stole their identity. We did an event a few weekends ago where I taught a privacy class, and somebody said that an individual hacked into their baby monitoring system and they heard this guy's voice come through the speaker. So it's like, it's moments like that that get people's attention. But aside from that, you got a lot of people out there who are probably really exposed and don't understand it because they think, oh, I gave my email address or my phone number and that's all the information I shared. But like you, as you alluded to before, it's all that behavioral data. They're building this profile on you.
I can actually give you an example. And this actually happened in my friend's circle. One of my friends, I'm going to name, their mother is constantly getting phone calls scammed. Now, she participates in social media and they will phone her up on the phone. And because she is old and she is infirm, and she is getting on in years, she doesn't quite understand things, and they will manipulate that incredibly easily. And unfortunately, it's got to the point where her children have had to take her access off her own bank because people will phone up claiming they're from Microsoft and actually talk her through putting this stuff onto her computer so they can access it, and then she'll give them her credit card. Now, for the old out there, unfortunately, this is a huge problem, but this is where the telephony companies themselves could actually help. I mean, it would not be that hard to develop a product for a telephony company that scans the phone calls because, by the way, this would be easy for the United States because you guys have got the Patriot Act on September 11th. So, and you guys are already used to everybody listening in on all your phone calls. This would be super easy. It wouldn't even be an extra invasion of your privacy because it's already invaded. They could build a scanner that basically scans for certain types of dialogue. And when they hear people responding to this dialogue, it can just instantly go, alert. Unfortunately, this is a scam call for your own protection. This call is being terminated for these reasons. You'll find you can have access to this information on so-and-so Earl. That would fix about 90% of telephone scams in one hit. But again, this comes down to the problem of why the current model for profit is also halting innovation. As we just demonstrated, just off the top of our heads, we could calculate a very easy way to fix this problem. But the telephony companies don't. Why? Because why would they spend extra money on fixing this when at the moment they don't get fined, even though it's their platforms being used to conduct the fraud and they provide the infrastructure for it? And actually, technologically, there would be a way of stopping it, as we ourselves have just hypothesized, just off the top of our heads. Because they're not being fined and they're not being pushed to, they do not build what would actually be an innovation, something that would advance their technology, something that would improve their technology for everybody and would actually have worldwide benefit. We don't operate that way. Vox Messenger has a conventional interface at the moment. We're actually spending the last couple of years building a brand new UI for messaging that visually indicates changes in security and privacy to a person visually and in real time. Completely unique. And that's coming out in Vox Messenger next year. So you won't have to study lots of things. It'll be shown you instantly. This is what we're hoping other companies will kind of copy from us, is that focus on helping the consumer to stay safe and be better. If the consumer is safe and is happy, we can profit more from the consumer. If the consumer actually has sovereignty and control of their data, guess what? They're more likely to share it with us actually reciprocally. And that actually has more value, because here's the problem with people building. I'll give you an example, Palantir. You gotta love Palantir. They've built the world's most advanced spy system based off of scraping the internet and social media. It's beautiful. The problem is it doesn't account for the fact that 90% of what people write on social media is an absolute lie about themselves, which means they're already playing with poisoned data. I mean, a Vox Messenger, because we are passionate about making sure that people have privacy, we're building in something into the next version of Vox Messenger called the Mikoshi Protocol, which is to help journalists, activists, and other protected groups of people from having their phones cloned. Because here in the United Kingdom, if you're stopped by the police, for example, particularly if you're Black, chances are you'll end up with your phone being cloned. Now, they'll do that because they want access to your contacts and everything on your handset, because apparently you are a potential threat just by virtue of being a little bit darker on the shade wheel, should we say. Now, with the Mikoshi protocol, A, Vox Messenger can't be cloned. If you try to run it on a cloned phone, it knows that the actual phone is changed. You won't be able to communicate on it. So you can't spoof it by cloning it like you can other messengers. Also, with the Mikoshi protocol, if somebody induces you to put in your PIN, you put the Mikoshi PIN in. And what happens is it takes a picture of who's actually compromised your phone, records the audio for 30 seconds, sends that to everybody on your access list to let them know that you've been compromised, erases your contacts list and erases all of your messaging and contact content, and then replaces it with synthetic data. So imagine when that gains mainstream adoption, when that technology is out there and gains mainstream adoption, you would only need 500,000 people, and that poisons that entire capability for data extraction and exploitation in one hit. And that's my point. Companies can do more to help consumers. And in the modern world, given that corporations are now far more powerful than any government and have already demonstrated themselves to generally have the best interests of the majority of their consumers in their interests, basically behooves corporations to start taking a more benevolent and more hands-on approach in how they help society. If you're a company that is making trillions, millions upon millions and billions from people's data, it does behoove you to help fix some of the problems that are occurring in society, particularly if it's your technology that's causing those problems. For example, there is a provable link between the growth in behavioral and psychological and emotional problems in our youth of today and the adoption of Instagram and TikTok. Just perhaps it should behoove those companies to put some of their profits into research programs and charities specifically focused on fixing those problems. But again, if you're running on the Barnes and Freudian consumer capitalism model, that doesn't really enter into the equation, because you do not view those people, you don't actually care, because you're actually only looking at you only need one level of consumers. But the reality is, in the 21st century, when the consumer can actually control their consumer destiny, that changes, and companies have to evolve, as opposed to companies trying to stamp their feet, trying to say, no, keep it the old way. It's time to evolve. And it's the companies that are willing to evolve and are agile enough too that will survive the next 30, 50, 100, 200, 500 years. Cryotech is a 2,000-year company. We're not looking at selling out and just being around for 10, 20 years.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah, in an age where everybody's looking for the exit, right?
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah. It ties into your passion for sure. What about, you're doing a lot of work too on the facial recognition side of things. Maybe you can talk about that and what kind of problems you're trying to solve.
We've just filed a patent for a new technology which allows for fully autonomous, intelligent real-time camera sync. Now, what does this mean? At the moment, if you want to get a 3D scan of a person using multiple sensors, like for games, for sports, for anything to do with the metaverse, you're going to have to use this very expensive sensor called a Kinect DK or an Orbeck. And you're going to have somebody walking around with QR codes like Boxing Ring Girl, or you're going to have to put these big QR code markers everywhere. And if you're unlucky, now, once you've done the synchronization, which in itself can take ages, if you're unlucky enough for somebody to breeze past or for a plane to go overhead and one of the sensors even moves 500,000, you've got to redo it again. Now, in the 3D scanning space, one of the premium studios in the space is Dimension Studios, and they charge $6,000 a minute for 3D scanning. And it's kind of the standard. Now, the reality is 3D scanning has become this incredibly elitist, top-tier activity. which is a problem because the metaverse, which is effectively World 2.0, if we've had World 1, which is all reality layer 1, which is what we experience every day, then layer 2 would be the metaverse. And if the metaverse is going to be a world that everyone can participate in, that basically means we cannot have barriers to entry, like the only way to get a proper millimeter resolution 3D scan of yourself as an avatar in your physical self there is going to require thousands. That basically means this is a technology in a world that is only open to a certain few. And this is, again, something I view as a problem. So to fix that problem, you first of all have to fix the initial problem of how do you get the data there? How do you make it so you don't have to have that studio? How do we fix that barrier of entry into the metaverse? And that's what we did. We created Markerless Camera Sync so you can have any number of sensors around you and you don't need to have a PhD in marker sync or mathematics to do it. It just works. You become the marker in a very special way. We also increased compatibility because at the moment, the industry is obsessed with using one sensor, which was made by Microsoft. It costs over $700 and is harder than a unicorn fart to acquire in the modern age. So we're actually using something called the Luxonis Oak D. This sensor is unique in the field. It's the only sensor that actually has a Intel Myriad X chip on it, which means it can do all of the clever AI stuff all on the sensor. Now, why is that important? Well, if you're going to run computer vision or any computer vision system in Europe, you need to be able to do all of the neural inference and machine learning stuff like object recognition, facial recognition, all of that stuff, tracking the lot natively on device. You cannot do it on a third-party service because it breaches privacy. Now, we are the only people who have developed technology that can use pretty much the only sensors available with that ability. And we have that built in natively. We also went off and acquired one of the oldest companies in the space that built this amazing software that is basically like the Adobe of end-to-end 3D scanning. It literally is. It means you can literally do your 3D scanning and calibration and linear 3D particle editing all in one application. It's amazing. The industry standard is DepthKit, but theirs costs $3,000 a month just to use. And it looks like something designed by a Linux expert. It's one of those things, you know what I'm saying? Those gray windows with the weird looking dialogues in. So we acquired the easiest to use piece of software with some of the most interesting and awesome tech in the background. It also gave us a patent, which is the world's first lossless compression codec for 3D point cloud data for mobile, which we're codifying and turning into an actual codec as well as we speak. Now, this basically means with this technology, you'll be able to set up these sensors, by the way, they cost about $120. So as opposed to $700 plus to get this super rare sensor, we're able to use a sensor that's under $200 and it's made from components which are even readily available when there is two wars going on in the world, one of which is happening in Europe. So this basically means we've managed to not just make the technology quicker, we've actually managed to make it like an every person technology, a technology that is not expensive to get hold of and a technology that's not hard to get hold of. These are the kinds of steps which everybody should be looking at, particularly when designing and building a technology that's going to be consumer facing in the 21st century. And it's going to touch on AI and then it's going to touch on the metaverse and it's going to touch on the blockchain. Now, with the software we've designed, your 3D data that you scan, you don't just save it as a file on your computer. You can actually then mint it onto the Solana blockchain as an asset that you can license and own. And we provide that in one end-to-end piece of software. We end-to-end encrypt it. And the reason for this is because at the moment, particularly in the metaverse and the 3D industries, nobody seems to be thinking of the huge attack surfaces that are being created here. Bear in mind, if you're scanning yourself and you're creating a one-to-one digital twin of yourself for ID purposes, you need to be able to trust the transmission in between. Because if it's not end-to-end encrypted, or it's not encrypted in transit at the very least, somebody using a man-in-the-middle attack could alter your 3D data before it's even gone to the ID verification system, which basically means, yes, your ID would work for you, but without you even realizing it, your supposedly 100% unspoofable digital twin contains a component which makes it compliant with another person. So we are also end-to-end encrypting all of our 3D data and content, actually at the point of scanning, which is also another world first, as far as I know.
The metaverse, where is it going?
The metaverse, where is it going? The metaverse is going to be going into two places. Yes, there is going to be this horrific Ready Player Me universe out there, which is only accessible using a VR headset. And it's going to be gash. It's going to be horrible. It's going to be ads. It's going to be run by the big corporations. And it's going to make you sick every 5 minutes. But then there is going to be the AR metaverse, which is the metaverse you're actually going to spend probably about 90% of your time. And that is the metaverse experienced through your Samsung glasses. Or if you are feeling particularly cyberpunk and out there, the metaverse experienced through your VR headset with 4K pass-through. You're going to look like a complete twat wearing it. And yes, it's going to make you feel like you're somebody out of Cyberpunk 2077. But the reality is it's impractical. It's going to give you a headache every 5 minutes. And it's going to make your face sweat. And you're just going to end up with a face mark tattoo on your face. The rest of us normal people will be experiencing the metaverse via AR and what we call extended reality. And extended reality is the actual interaction between 4K photorealistic virtual elements into the augmented real.
So you think long term, there is an application. It's going to survive. Is it just that Meta has kind of bungled it a little bit?
Did Facebook bundle the metaverse? No, Sherlock. Yeah. I mean, let's break it down. Facebook were actually partnered with a company called Meta. Did you know that? And they were partnered with this little company called Meta. And Facebook were actually funding them a little bit. And they actually used to co-locate at events and stuff. And this little scrappy organization called Meta was actually doing lots of work in VR. Anyway, imagine the shock and horror of the founder of that Meta when he turned around one day, found that his main partners, Facebook, had announced without any consultation with them, Google this, by the way, it's an actual thing, had literally stolen their freaking name. Then we have Meta Cortex, which is a bank, a DeFi financial organization who've owned the trademark for the Meta Cortex name for half a decade. And the only reason they had a problem and had to get involved is because of what Facebook did with their trademark. Now, applying for a trademark in itself is not a bad thing. Anybody can apply for a trademark. I don't care. There's a reason I went after the UK trademark for Meta, because Meta did exactly what they do in every industry, which is that they went in to dominate. They didn't just buy one trademark to Meta. They actually paid for over 50,000 subclasses. Now, in trademarking, you have primary levels, which could be, say, computing or computing and software. And they have subclasses, which is software development, VR, blah, 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 and all of this, which basically means you can have companies with the same name, but in different classes of industry. You see what I mean? Now, what Meta did was they must have spent millions on this filing. And they basically went to own the word Meta in every class of business in the world. That's monopolization, and that is anti-competitive. Now, they're already in court in the United States with Meta and the Meta Cortex company, and both of those are floundering, and they're getting their heads kicked in because they do not have dominance. They do not have dominion. The reality is those two other companies have already held the Meta trademark, especially the original Meta company, who was their partner, for well over 10 years. So they've got this. So what did Meta try to do? Facebook went and set up a little shell company that went and bought over 100 Meta trademarks from the Jamaican Trademark Office. Because why? The Jamaican Trademark Office is part of the big Paris Accord. And if you can get your trademark signed and sealed in a Paris Accord country, guess what? You can influence the outcome of everybody else, despite what they will try to tell you. So they came here. Now, I'd already trademarked it. I trademarked it pretty much as soon as I had the idea. So I already had the trademark, and I was literally 1 week away from being awarded it when Stobbs sent me a very obnoxious letter, a very pompous, obnoxious letter, telling me to give it to them because they were Stobbs and it was Meta. And I did what I always do when somebody tells me to do something unequivocally, which was to sit there, laugh, tell them to go F themselves, and then come up with a way to battle them, which I did. They thought Meta, Facebook went up against me in court in the United Kingdom. They actually had the senior partner of Stobbs go up against me, and they thought they had it. And actually, no, I managed to convince the judge that the entire case should be suspended pending the results of the US court cases. In fact, there are over 90 different oppositions to the Meta trademark to Facebook here in the United Kingdom, including Dell and including some big names. But they have all been sat at suspension because of my hearing, which basically means they have no choice but to win in the United States. Now, since then, I've already recruited DLA Piper, so it's all good. I have no issue seeing DLA Piper and Stobbs fight it out. I mean, that'll be funny.
We've talked about crypto wallets and crypto communications, and also a little bit about AI, facial recognition. By the way, I don't know where you find any free time, but it sounds like you could use a vacation maybe.
My wife tells me that all the time, because not only I own all these companies and do all this, I'm also married. I have four children. My three eldest also live with me, who are 18, 17, and 15. And my youngest is 7, who I see every fortnight. Hopefully he'll be coming to live with me very soon. Oh, and I'm a Freemason as well.
I can barely take care of myself. I don't know how you do it.
I sleep very little and I smoke inordinate amounts of weed. I'm definitely an advocate for cannabis consumption. It's incredibly healthy. I've had one cold in 5 years. I had COVID once. I am being vaccinated. I only had it for 3 days. I'm able to deal with tons of stress. I'm able to deal with the aggro of living and being black in Britain. And I haven't killed anybody and I don't shout at anybody. So yeah, it's good.
Good for you. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about in terms of the technology, where it's going, the privacy space, big tech, you name it, before we wrap up?
I would probably say that we've all been told in society, and even our parents have told us this, which is that we've all been told that the world is too big and everything in the world is too big for us as individuals to change. And I can say from my own personal life experience that is absolute and utter nonsense. We create our realities. On a fundamental level, when you understand quantum mechanics, you will definitely be able to see that we can influence and control our reality. There is no such thing as problem being too big for you. You are the individual. You have sovereignty and you have the power to create whole new worlds and whole new ways of thinking, literally in a minute. So I'd say the last thing I would say to wrapping up is, don't believe everything you read. Be a critical thinker and lean into your imagination, because there is no such thing as impossible, just very hard to do.
Those are good words of wisdom.
Well, we shall see. We'll see if it's wisdom or just tomfoolery.
Well, JV, I appreciate your time. This was awesome. Very unique. I love your passion. And boy, I wish I had your energy.
Dude, it's very easy to develop this energy. Focus on something. Lots of people will tell you the world is a very dark place right now. Yes, it is. But what we are being shown throughout the world is that everything is impermanent. It doesn't matter what bad things happen or whether or not bad things continue to happen. Things change. They change all the time. And it's that impermanence that maintains my hope, because it means it doesn't matter how dark the night gets, the dawn will always be bright.
On that note, we'll let you go. Maybe we can do this again sometime soon. This was fun.
Yeah, I'd love to be back.
All right, man. Thanks so much for your time, JV. Appreciate it.
Take it easy, dude.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Privacy Files. In our next episode, we'll be getting back on track by addressing the importance of compartmentalizing one's digital life. I will be joined in studio by a special guest from the Anonymy Labs team to talk about an exciting new product release for MySudo, the web browser extension. With the holiday season upon us, shopping privately and securely just got way easier. Until next time, don't forget, privacy is a human right.